The frogs.
Bollocks.
Hello.
Hi,
and welcome to episode 5 of The Frogs Bollocks. We're halfway through.
Yeah, halfway through already.
I know. And I do apologise if I sound like I've aged about 80 years. I'm a little bit poorly.
Yeah, a bit sniffly, aren't you?
I'm a little bit sniffly. And when I'm sniffly, I tell you it's the end of the world.
Yeah.
I do not do very well with colds.
You don't. You just proper like retreat and you think the world's going to end and everything closes it on you and you just can't cope.
It's going to implode on itself.
Yeah.
No, I think the thing is that I don't get ill that often.
No.
So it takes a lot to bring me down, but when it brings me down, I can't hack it. I'm a weakling. I just want a hot water bottle and I want to watch... Oh God, I'm going to be honest here. My guilty pleasure. I want to watch Married at First Sight.
Yeah.
And I want to eat chocolate.
Yeah.
You know, and I just don't want to do anything else.
The thing is, you do the right thing and kind of go into like self-preservation mode. When I'm ill, I'm like, no, I'm not ill. I'm going to do something. I'm going to go for a run and do a workout or something that just tries to beat it out of me, which ultimately makes it worse. But I just don't like sitting still.
No. Whereas I just admit defeat. Although saying that, we've had to get up quite early to do this podcast this morning. Because I've got a very long drive. I've got to drive south.
Yeah,
so.
I feel really sorry for you. I feel like I can't look after you anymore.
It's fine. We power on through and we've got lots of fun, exciting things coming up.
Yeah. So, starting off, as always, what have you been up to other than just dying in a corner?
Well, mainly dying in a corner. What have we been doing? Well, again, we've spent a bit of time out in the garden, which has been nice. Actually dug a couple of trees in the ground, because sometimes with trees you have to kind of let them sit for a while and really soak them in the wet ground.
Yeah.
So there's a few trees that have gone into the ground, which is really nice. Been out walking, which is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Otherwise, I've been rotting on the sofa.
Yeah, you have. Bless you.
How about you?
Fun enough, the same. Just I've been handing you lots of different things, your juices and your drugs and your blankets and your water bottles, just trying to look after you.
Paracetamol, by the way, just to make that clear.
The hard stuff, yeah.
Yeah, the really hard stuff.
Yeah. No, it's been quite a gentle week, isn't it, really, which is quite nice. Sometimes we are running around 100 miles an hour all the time, and then sometimes we just like to just chill out a little bit, which is nice.
Although, being said that, I've done a lot of writing this week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done something for the Radio Times, which will be coming out, I don't know when, but at some point.
It's good.
Doing a bit of writing for them, and that's one of the reasons why I've got to head south, actually, is because I'm doing something for them later on and doing bits and filming. So lots of stuff going on, but I've got to admit, my wildlife highlight for the week, honestly, was watching mammals last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think when you work in wildlife television, you don't often sit down and allow yourself to watch it very often.
No, this is the weirdest thing. We both work in wildlife TV and we rarely have the time to watch TV, which is other than Married at First Sight.
Oh, I know. You've got morale into that.
I know. I just really didn't want to be into it. And yet here I am kind of engrossed, annoyingly.
Yeah, you shouted at the telly.
I was.
Throwing things. I can't go an episode ahead, otherwise I won't hear the end of it.
No, not allowed now. Yeah, no, we don't tend to watch a lot of wildlife shows. We tend to watch them a lot later than they come out. But actually, right now, we're watching mammals live, which is great.
Well, we've watched episode one, because so far it's just the episode about the dark has come out. And that was really nice. And there's some really interesting research that looks at, obviously, nature connection. And we know being outside, like watching nature, being out in the elements is so good for our mental health. But actually, it's not quite as good, but still pretty good, to get your nature connection virtually through watching it on the television.
Oh, definitely.
So it's still that form of nature connection. There's a really great book by Miles Richardson called Reconnection. Really highly recommend it. But it talks all about kind of that connection to nature. And it's amazing that you can get a good serotonin hit from nature virtually as you can, you know, from seeing it in real life. Not quite as good, but pretty much, like, it's there.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't always get the opportunity to see hippos and rhinos and lemurs and leopards. So to be able to see it on TV and get immersed in the soundscape, because that's the thing, is these programs, their technology is getting better and better visually, but also audibly.
Yeah.
And you really get submersed in these wildlife documentaries, and it's great.
Yeah, very similar. I think my favourite sequence from it was the fennec foxes.
Yeah, they're cool.
God, I just want to squeeze them. I've got this thing when something's cute, I just want to hold it really tight.
That's a real thing, though, isn't it? That's a real, like,
yeah. It's either squeezing or biting, I think.
Yeah, such a weird thing.
I just, like, clamp down. Not that I would clamp down on the fender, but just putting it out there. But when you, like, you just, it's the Lenny effect, isn't it? Like, of Mice and Men at school, do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, Lenny, bless
That's
him.
A throwback.
Yeah, it was obviously the story of these two brothers. And Lenny, the much bigger one, had some learning difficulties. And, he had a mouse in his pocket that he loved so much that he squeezed it to death.
Oh, that's such a sad
story.
No,
I'm not going to squeeze a fennec fox today.
No.
I will not actually touch a fennec fox because I don't believe in that kind of thing. But, oh God, just to see those beautiful big ears was amazing.
Yeah.
And the hyenas too, another favourite of mine. I've done some work and some filming with hyenas out in Namibia, with brown hyenas specifically, looking at hyena scent marking and specifically hyena anal paste.
And how did you do such research?
I stuck my fingers up one's ass.
Yeah. What a claim to fame. Stuck your finger up a hyena's ass.
I have done. But I some people might think that's a weird. I mean, it was under anaesthetic. Can I just say, like, I didn't just run up to a wild hyena and just,
hey, come here,
catch
you.
It by surprise.
Tail between its legs.
It was a female, and we were, I think she had a bit, she had a battery changed in a radio collar, and took a poo sample, and in order to get a fresh poo sample,
because you had to
put your hand up a bum, but if, because you can take obviously poo samples from the ground, but actually because hyena poo is so low in water content, it dries out really quickly, and that can damage sometimes some of the samples that you're trying to take. So the best thing to do is go to the source.
Okay, noted. Next time I need a poo sample from a hyena, I'm just going straight for the source, like you said.
It's up in there. But no, it was great. And we actually had the opportunity to use an ultrasound on her, and she was pregnant. Really early stages, but that was really nice to see.
Much nicer.
Yeah, hyena anal paste. People should make a documentary about it, because I'm telling you, that stuff is fascinating. I've smelt it. It doesn't smell that bad. Promise you. It's all right.
Gross.
What the fact?
Each week, Megan and I go head-to-head in a fact-off called What the Fact, and we present to each other the best fact through a chosen category, which this week we've gone for mimicry.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And as we mentioned last week, we're not doing a forfeit every single week. We're going to do a forfeit for the whole series. So once we've presented our facts, there will be a poll available on our Twitters where you can cast your vote to who you think is the winner. And then at the end of the series, we'll count it all up, and whoever loses ultimately will have to do a forfeit.
Yeah, please do vote. At the minute from last week...
Finally,
you are,
victory is mine.
We do have another day left to go on the poll.
Yeah, I did say last week the poll will be open all the time, but actually no, there's a limit on Twitter of like, what, a week?
Damn it, Elon.
Yeah,
it's your fault,
Elon. Come on, sort it out.
Yeah.
Do you want to go first?
Okay, I feel like I've got to bring the pressure this week, because you sniped it from me last time with your randy mallards. Okay, so I'll go first. Mimicry is typically evolved to discourage predation, but most examples when we think of it are quite visual. So for example, you've got hoverflies, which kind of look like wasps.
Yeah,
they've got the striped banding, that yellow orange color. You even get things like milk snakes, which mimic corn snakes, but milk snakes don't have any venom. They're actually entirely, well,
harmless,
whereas corn snakes are not. So it's all about tricking your threat into thinking that you might be something scarier than you are.
Yeah, or to entice some prey in.
Yeah, or to entice prey. There's various different ways, but it generally is all about kind of predation. But there's been new research in 2021 done, which has looked at acoustic mimicry.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to play you this sound, and I want you to tell me what you think it is. What does it sound like?
Sounds like machine guns.
Machine guns.
No, it's buzzing. It's high pitched. It's kind of grasshopper, cicada like.
Okay.
Buzzing, kind of, yeah, just insectivorous.
Insectivorous. Well, you're along the right lines with insect. Well, you are spot on with insect. So this sound wasn't actually made by an insect. It was made by a greater mouse-eared bat, which are quite a, you know, a widespread species across Europe.
If I was to try and work it out, I would have gone for echolocation because a lot of these bat recordings sound kind of like that, kind of alien, where actually that's not the frequency they call at, but they've brought the frequency down to match something that we can hear.
Yeah, exactly. And bats, you know, auditory repertoire is so much more advanced than our own.
Yeah.
And they're remarkable. I love bats. They're fascinating, fascinating mammals. So the greater mouse-eared bat, as I said, is quite widespread across Europe. But it feeds on insects and especially likes beetles. But it hangs out in colonies around woodlands and forest edges, can roost in caves underground for most of the year. Then, of course, during the summer when it's warmer, you can see it out and about being a little bit more active. But they are usually preyed upon by birds like barn owls and tawny owls.
All right.
It's one of their most common predators. So
That's amazing for, you think how fast and how agile a bat can fly.
Yeah.
And then you go for a barn owl or tawny owl, which, as elegant as they are as flyers, I don't really say they're agile. They're not quick.
No,
the
they're not fast. They can, you know, turn a corner as quickly as a bat can.
No, exactly. It's not surprising that they can catch.
But remember, when you've got bats coming out of roosts, they're coming out sometimes thousands, hundreds at a time.
Mm.
So therefore, if a, you know, an owl was aware of this and was waiting, perched up for the you know, emergence of all these bats.
Yeah, true.
It could fly in and grab one without having to worry too much about accuracy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is still pretty amazing.
It's amazing, yeah.
Pretty amazing. So Danilo Russo at the University of Naples Federico in Italy was trying to understand these bats. And he's been working with this species for over 2 decades. And when he was handling them, he noticed that they started to buzz. Now, we've known that bats buzz for quite a long time, but exactly why, no one was entirely sure. And he was only able to recently understand it. The scientists were able to understand how the owls would perceive the sound that these bats were making by just changing the frequencies slightly, because of course as humans we have our limitations to what we can hear, whereas owls it's much wider.
Yeah.
So they changed the sound slightly from the bats to basically understand exactly what the owls would hear.
Okay.
And by doing so they found that, to us that buzzing sounds like an insect, but to an owl it sounds almost identical to a hornet, bee, or wasp, something that which could potentially sting it and harm it.
Interesting.
So they played these buzzes to a series of 8 owls. Some were captive and some were wild. And they found that the wild owls had a greater reaction to the buzzes that were produced by the bats. Mm-hmm. And they stayed away from the bats entirely.
Mm.
And this is because wild owls come into hornets, bees, wasps much more often than ones held in captivity. So they had a greater reaction to it.
So they were afraid of the wasp or bee for getting stung.
Yeah, they were nervous that that meant danger. So ultimately, they stayed away from their favourite prey, which were the bats, because the bats were mimicking the sound of an insect, which is the first time it's ever been recorded, a mammal mimicking the sound of a stinging insect for survival.
That's cool.
There you go. First time ever.
So these, the buzzing isn't a, is it a, it's a vocalisation, or is it more of like a, what
is
it?
It's a vocalisation.
It's a vocalisation, but it's not, the only purpose of this vocalisation is for deterring
their
owls,
predators.
Their predators. It's not for communication between other bats, or it's not an echolocation.
Nope.
It's purely to imitate wasps and hornets and bees to deter owls.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool.
It's very cool. But they think that this has happened long ago. So we've been actually hearing bats buzz for a long while. And they think that this evolved many moons ago, but also amongst different species. So there's a lot of research underway now to understand this for the wild in many different species, because it's not just this one. I think that's pretty cool, and that is a first for science.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the time when you're talking about mimicry, it's between like predator and prey, but this involves a whole new, totally unrelated animal where these bats are like, I'm just going to pretend to be something with a dangerous bum. Like a hornet, be a wasp.
What's with you and bums today, honestly?
Okay, try and beat that, James. Bring your best shot to the table.
Okay, so for my animal, I've chosen butterflies. Beautiful, fluttery emblems of summer. The little jewels flying across the meadows. The beautiful golden blues and reds and colours and beautiful animals that are butterflies.
I know there's a plot happening in your voice. Something is afoot.
Yeah, because it turns out butterflies aren't as nice as they seem.
What is right? Last week you did this. You butchered everybody's favourite duck. And now here you are with coming after butterflies. What is your problem?
Okay, it's only one butterfly that I'm going to just trash.
Okay.
But butterflies are very good mimics. A lot of species have these eye spots on their wings, these eyelets, that are there to mimic eyeballs, which are either going to deter its predator. The predator is going to see the eyes and think, oh my God, what's this? I'm not going to eat this. Or if it's not deterred, they act as a kind of a redirection for the pecking, for the attack. So if a bird was to attack a peacock butterfly, which has these big eye spots, the theory is they'll go and peck at the eyes, but they'll avoid the kind of the organs, the main structure of the butterfly that it needs to survive.
Its body.
Mm. But if it pecks the wings, it can get a couple of holes and will still roughly be able to fly. But the main thing is it survives. So for a peacock's mimicry, it's just doing it for survival. Now there's a butterfly that's mimicking, but for a more sinister reason.
Right.
So there's a butterfly called the large blue butterfly. Now this is probably my favourite butterfly of all because I've got a bit of a relationship with it.
Okay.
It was one of the first films I ever made was on the large blue. Now they're quite a rare species. They're the largest species of the blues, the blue family, so the common blue, the silver studded, the Adonis, etc. The largest of the blues, but they're still quite small. They're kind of a medium-sized butterfly. And in 1979, they went extinct. There were none left in the UK, so various reintroduction programs brought them back through incredible conservation work, and there are now some really good strongholds across the country, and one of them being in Gloucestershire, where I was born and raised. And I did a film with the Gloucestershire Wildlife Trust back when I was maybe 18, and there was a big nature reserve that was basically up for sale, and the future of the large blues there was kind of up in the air because if it went to development, they would obviously ruin that habitat. And so I worked with the team to create a film to help raise awareness and to help raise funds to buy this plot of land. And the whole team, everyone together, managed to buy this reserve. And now that reserve is a massive stronghold for the large blue butterfly. So as an 18-year-old young wildlife filmmaker, I was immensely proud. I was like, film that I've made has made a difference. So I've got a bit of a relationship with the large blues. They're one of my favourite butterflies. But like I said, they are quite sinister.
Yeah, all right. Tell me how.
So, as an adult, they're flying around and they're feeding on wild thyme and marjoram plants, and it's where they lay their eggs, and the eggs will hatch, and they'll go through several changes, which are called instars. As they kind of grow older, the caterpillars will change their shape and their form, and by about the fourth instar, it changes its behaviour. So it stops feeding on the plant and just falls to the ground.
Why would it, is that because it's concerned about predation from birds? Or because I'd imagine actually on the ground would be more of a dangerous place to be.
It is a more dangerous place to be because there are lots of other insects. I mean, these caterpillars are tiny as well. These large blue caterpillars are immensely small, smaller than an ant. And
oh, really tiny.
Really tiny. And these ants could predate them. However, it's exactly the ants that it wants to attract.
Interesting.
Which may seem counterintuitive, but it's not. It's calculated. So,
devious devils.
Devious little devils. So these large blue caterpillars are on the ground and they're waiting, basically. They can wander around, but they're waiting for the ant, Myrmicus abelite, this red ant, to come and find it. As soon as it does, it instantly secretes a honeydew, this sugary kind of secretion, a sugary liquid, which ants just love. It's just tasty. It's a tasty little treat. Yeah. So as soon as the ant sees the caterpillar releases the honeydew and is like, oh, delicious. What's this? Ooh, a bit of a afternoon snack. And that's deception number one. It lures them in with some sugary goodness.
Yeah, lots of energy and sugar. So that if I was an ant, I'd lap it up.
Exactly. So once it's got the ant hooked on this sugary treat, it then releases these chemical odours, which basically then tricks the ant to thinking the caterpillar is one of its own.
Okay, so there's like a double whammy of disguise going on there.
Double
or
whammy
attraction.
Yeah, but there's a triple. There's a third. There's brand new research which has showed that these caterpillars not only release a kind of a chemical signature to fool the ants, but they also emit an acoustic sound to mimic that of a queen ant.
How on earth do they do that?
So it kind of puffs up its body and then squeezes the air out, and in doing so can basically, yeah, mimic the call of a queen ant. So it's
amazing.
It's got these chemical odours which make it smell like an ant or an ant grub. It then calls out like a queen in distress, and the ant goes, "Oh, right, oh, you're one of ours, right? Come back with us, ma'am. Come this way, we'll find you back to the nest." And yeah, this Myrmica sabuleti ant then picks it up and takes it back to the nest. And as soon as it's there, it's got free roam of the entire nest and the entire colony. And by doing this acoustic kind of simulation, it gets the royal treatment. It gets taken care of, it gets looked after, it gets priority treatment over the other ant grubs, and basically it can just go about its thing. Now, this is why it's sinister. It's because the large blue caterpillar wants to be in the ant's nest because it wants to eat the ant grubs.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's a high protein for it. It enables it to grow.
Exactly. So it spends basically an entire year underground eating away all of these ant grubs, getting big and fat and eventually pupating and becoming and emerging as an adult large blue butterfly to start the process all over again.
So every large blue that we see has spent a year in an ant's nest,
yeah,
deceiving, lying,
yeah,
and just being an all-round rock star.
Being a rock star, just eating its way through the ant grub colony, all the while getting kind of this yeah, royal treatment from the ants. It's like the ultimate deception.
Love me while I eat you.
Yeah. Exactly. Don't mind me munching on your siblings and your children.
Oh, I love nature. It's mad.
Oh, it's wacky. So this is like a, yes, it's a cuckoo. It's a cuckoo parasite, but it's a butterfly.
Yeah.
You just don't think of them as being parasitic or these kind of deceptive little bastards. But they are. In the adult form, they're beautiful. Wouldn't hurt a fly.
Well, sort of.
Flitting around these meadows. But yeah, underground, there's a whole different story happening.
It's a dark side to the butterflies we know and love.
Yeah.
No, I quite like that as well, because we've both gone for examples which aren't visual.
Yeah.
Which is quite good, because most of the time, like I said, it was visual. So I like the fact that, you know, it can be mimicry through excreting the right kind of chemicals or the right kind of sound. Like, that's just awesome.
It is awesome. Now, if you'd like to see, there's a beautiful sequence on the large blues. If you look at Wild Isles on BBC iPlayer, Wild Isles came out a couple years ago, last year. Yeah. You can find it on BBC iPlayer, and in the Grasslands episode, they do cover this very sequence, and it's just incredible to be able to see this whole sequence happening. It's amazing.
I'd highly recommend giving it a watch, because often we don't really look in as much detail with British nature, but our home is definitely where the heart is. And these kind of mysterious underground, undercover stories of survival, you know, there is just nothing better than trying to decode and understand what's going on in those scenarios.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
And it's amazing. I like that it's new research as well. I think for a long time, we knew of the large blue caterpillars emitting these chemical signatures, but it's only recently that they discovered this acoustic signature as well. It's incredible. Yeah. We're learning so much all the time, and that's what makes nature awesome.
It's cool. It's for the cool kids.
For the cool kids.
Yeah.
So there you go. Those are our facts based on mimicry. What do you prefer? The deceptive large blue butterfly?
Or the hornet buzzing bats?
Hornet buzzing bats. Cast your votes now.
Now, if there's been a question at the back of your mind about anything natural history related or about us that you've just been pondering and not really entirely sure of the answer, please do let us know. We'd be really keen to answer your questions. You can get in contact with us at info@thefrogsbollocks.com or through social media. We'd love to hear from you.
Deb on Facebook asks, which species has the most intense and productive stomach acid for digesting its diet?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. And there is one very clear winner with the strongest stomach acid for digesting its diet. But the way that we measure stomach acid is all about pH. Now, if you look at a typical pH scale, you've got 0, which is highly, highly acidic.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got 7, which is neutral in the middle. And then you've got 14, which is very much alkali. So basically no acid whatsoever. And
yeah,
you can measure these scales in various different ways. So to put that into a bit of perspective, car battery pH, quite high, 0.8.
Mm-hmm. Very high, acidic. Yeah.
Human stomach pH level, on the other hand, is 1.5 to 3.5, depending on the person and their diet.
Even that's pretty acidic.
Yeah. Yeah, very acidic, not quite as much, but still pretty high.
Yeah.
And you expect carnivores to have a higher acid stomach content than a herbivore, just because they have to, of course, digest meat and all the bacteria that comes with it. And you want to be able to digest that faster so it's not sitting in the stomach, becoming rotten, becoming rancid and making you quite unwell. So
yeah,
anything that wants to eat meat needs to digest it quickly, therefore you need stronger acid. Now, the absolute king and queens of the stomach acid, the crown, the creme de la creme of the toughest stomachs out there, goes to vultures.
Yeah.
Perhaps unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
Now, vultures are really cool. They're one of my favourite birds. People don't think they're very attractive. I think they're gorgeous. I think they're very cute. They can be very beautiful. Some vultures have really brightly coloured heads, you know, pinks, purples, blues. Gorgeous birds, and of course very big, and they're mostly known as being scavengers. So they find dead animals that lie around in the landscape, either visually or actually by scent, that we're learning more about every day. They're able to detect decaying matter through particles in the air and hone in on it, which means that they're eating quite rotten meat a lot of the time. But depending on the species of vulture, actually depends on what part of the animal their prey gets eaten. So for example, you get some vultures which come down and they're specialists in opening up a dead body, consuming some of the first tissues, some of the organs. Then you get some vultures that come in later on and pick off the bone, for example, like bearded vultures.
Yeah.
So bearded vulture is up there. They have a pH of 0.7 in their stomach, which is 0.1 point more acidic,
yeah,
than a car battery.
It's phenomenally acidic, isn't it? To
yeah,
be able to digest bone. And that's, I've always known that, well, I always thought that the bearded vulture was the most acidic.
Mm-mm-mm.
But it's not.
Turkey vulture takes that crown. Turkey most acidic vulture. Stomach around, which has a pH only just slightly above zero.
I think I say just slightly above the bearded vulture, but no, just slightly above, almost just ultra,
just
pure acid.
Pure acid is,
wow,
the turkey vulture. It's 100 times more concentrated than human gastric juice, which is a phrase I don't say often enough. Gastric juice, but there,
wowza,
we are. Turkey vultures have it. They're brilliant birds, you know, but they're also not what we think they are. So a friend of mine who works at the Hawke Conservancy Trust, he's head of conservation there, Campbell Mern, I actually interviewed him for my book, Atlas of Endangered Species. Did a whole thing about vultures because I'm slightly obsessed.
Yeah.
But I was talking
do
to...
Do read her book, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
Atlas of Endangered Species, phenomenal book.
Aww.
Available in all of your usual places, Waitrose and...
Waitrose?
Not Waitrose, what's the other one?
What do you mean?
Waterstones.
Waterstones.
Waterstones?
Yeah, Waterstones.
Waterstones.
You really read books.
I read a lot of books.
Thank you. But yeah, no, Campbell's, oh God, yeah, just an amazing, amazing guy. And he's observed vultures actively hunting a lot. So we're learning more that they're not just scavengers. I mean, obviously it depends on the species. But, you know, he's seen vultures go and attack mongoose and swallow them down in one. And of course, there's no evidence left behind. There's no blood, there's no bits of fur, there's no sign that they've actively hunted because they just like flick them up in the air and swallow them.
Yeah.
So, you know, we haven't really seen it much before and yeah, don't think of them as active hunters, but vultures definitely can be.
There's a really funny story that I've heard. I don't know how true it is, but that vultures would wait on the edge of these kind of minefields,
yeah,
where bigger animals, you know, deer, megafauna will go, get blown up, and the vultures like sweet, and then swoop on in and mm-hmm, pick up the remains. I think that's just ridiculous.
No, they
they've learned that if they just stay there long enough, something will get blown up and they can eat it.
No, they do. Brilliant birds. They need a lot more love. And also, just a shout out, if you are interested in coming to the Hawk Conservancy, my stepdad Chris Packham and I are doing a night of nature there in June, and there are still some tickets available if you would like to book on. There will be vultures flying around. We'll be doing lots of crazy things, showcasing the very best of birds of prey. So do look online at the Hawk Conservancy Trust website and book on to that really cool event. It's going to be good. Right, a question for you. Matty C on Instagram asks, what species are most at risk of global warming in the UK? Okay, that's, yeah, quite a big one.
Yeah, so climate change is affecting all species, all habitats throughout the world. There's nowhere that climate change isn't affecting in some degree. The UK is no exception. For example, our coastal areas are changing quite dramatically. They're getting warmer, so the distribution of plankton and nutrients is changing as the ocean currents are changing. So basking sharks are at risk. Our seabirds are at risk. We're seeing our rivers getting warmer, which affects the survival rates of fish eggs, in particular salmon, for example. We're seeing increased droughts every single year. We seem to be having these prolonged periods of droughts, which have massive knock-on effects. So it could be that they kill off the flowers before they have a chance to seed, or they're killing off butterfly eggs before they have a chance to hatch. So these are some really big impacts that are happening. Here in the Highlands, we're blessed with snow. However, every year there seems to be less and less snow. We have species like the ptarmigan and mountain hare, which turn white in the winter for camouflage. And as the snow retreats up the mountain, so do these animals. Eventually, climate change might mean there's no snow left. And where do they go after that? I mean, the ptarmigan can fly. Will they fly abroad? Probably not. So we probably will lose our ptarmigan species. The mountain hares can't fly, so they'll just be, you know, out in the open, ready to be picked off by predators, looking bright white in a heathery hillside. So these are some scary effects that are happening, and those are just a microcosm of what the bigger picture is, you know, that nothing is untouched by climate change. However, there are obviously lots of different projects happening which are looking at either mitigating for these effects or looking to reverse them in general. So I mentioned earlier that the warming rivers, there are lots of things that we can do, you know, by doing kind of regeneration and planting of trees in our upland rivers, which will then have that cooling effect. So actually that's possibly a good solution for our salmon. But for some of the kind of the bigger stories, like our warming oceans, I mean, there's not much we can do. The main thing is we've just got to, any other impact we're having on the environment, we've just got to reduce that that we're having the least impact that we can possibly have.
Yeah, it's about kind of thinking global, acting local. And that's become one of my favourite sayings, actually. I think that's really important. But it is hard, and there is a lot of doom and gloom out there. And I know we've touched on, you know, the fact that there is too much doom and gloom out there already in the series. But do you know what? When people ask me, you know, oh, I'm just getting into it, like, I'm you know, quite nervous about it because of all the negativity. I'm like, yeah, but there is real opportunity to make a difference right now. You know, to stand up and use your voice to really make sure that you're heard. And there's a lot worth fighting and saving. So, you know, the more people that can get on board and look at their behaviour, sure, and their lifestyle, absolutely. But also the people that can get on board and use their voice to think even bigger than that, like talking about making changes within their community or lobbying governments, lobbying MPs. I mean, my MP gets a bit annoyed because I send him countless emails and letters, always get a reply, not always the reply you want. But the more that you do that, it can seem disheartening if you don't get the response you want, but you're still applying the pressure. You're using your voice, you're asking for change at that bigger level, which is ultimately what we need to see. So, you know, I use all of these sad cases of all the wildlife and habitats around us being, you know, in trouble with climate change is motivation of like, okay, I'm going to get up rather than, you know, wallow about it and kind of watch it unfold before my eyes. I'm going to fight for it, because that's what we've got to do. You know, we've got to fight for it. And there's a lot of wonderful stuff that is happening and brilliant projects, like you say. Our special guest this week is one of my closest friends in the world. We met while studying zoology at the University of Liverpool, but she's now gone on to become a seriously cool and very talented scientist. She now works at the University of Brighton, and she's a PhD student studying something that I think most of us would take an interest in. So I'm going to hand over to my very good friend, Greya Gill.
Thank you very much for having me on, by the way, guys. I've been thoroughly enjoying listening to the pod and chuckling in my car out loud on my way to work, which is brilliant. So I am Greya. I am a PhD student at Brighton University, and I am getting dangerously close now to finishing, just about 6 months left. And my project has been looking at pesticide contamination in rivers, so freshwater environments. And I have been looking at what different combinations of pesticides that we find in the rivers have greater impacts than on their own. And I've been doing this by looking at their impact on the Asian clam, which is an invasive clam species. So clams and other bivalves are really important indicators of the health of water systems. And we use them especially when we're talking about pollutants. So the Mussel Watch program started in the 1970s, and this used blue marine mussels as biomonitoring systems. And this really launched the use of bivalves as sentinel species biomonitors in the environment. So we can put them out into specific places, and they will give us a good indication of which areas of a specific water body are more or less polluted, and also give us an indication of the sort of impact these pollutants might be having on wider ecology. So they're really good at this because they pump high volumes of water through their bodies every day. This is both for feeding and for breathing, essentially, which exposes them to whatever pollutants are in the water. So the Asian clam specifically has one of the highest filtration rates of any freshwater bivalve, and it can filter up to 1.3 litres of water an hour,
even though they're only between 6.6 and 60 millimetres long. So they're really efficient filterers.
So pesticides, by their design, are developed to cause harm or death to a specific pest, whether that be a weed, a fungus, a beetle species. And while they are designed to be as specific as possible, they often work by impacting pathways that can be seen across multiple life forms. So specific cells that we also have, or other plants also have. And since we know that pesticides often move away from the site where they're applied, and sometimes in high concentrations and along big distances, they pollute other environments, and they come into contact with non-target species, which also face harm from them. The other thing that's really important about the harm of pesticides is that some pesticides are really stubborn. They stay in the environment for years upon years. So, for example, DDT was one of the first synthetic pesticides. And it was actually found in a river 30 years after it had been banned, at levels that they still consider to be a potential risk to benthic organisms, so organisms like those mussels or clams. So they move long distances, they infect environments that we weren't expecting them to, and then they can stay there for a really, really long time. Almost a third of species that live in freshwater environments are facing extinction, and this is a greater proportion than both marine and terrestrial species. And the reason they're so amazing is because they hold such a plethora of biodiversity. They have a disproportionate number of plant and animals communities, even though they only make up 0.01% of the Earth's water. And the reason that they're so diverse is because a lot of these areas are found in isolation. So we've got big lakes up in the mountains, for example, and this really lends itself to evolution of new species. So they're really exciting and important places, most of all, to work in. Now, if I was all powerful for a day, so I thought about this a lot, and I came up with some really weird and wacky ideas that quite honestly just made me sound a bit insane. And I'm not saying this one doesn't, but insane in a different way. And I don't think it's something that's necessarily impossible. But what I would do is I would really want to just lock all the stakeholders in areas surrounding freshwater environments into a room for a day. So we've got farmers, water companies, ecologists, people in the local area, lock them in a room and say no one can leave till we find a solution that works. So this is where we've got food security. We need pesticides to maintain food security, or we need another plan. But we're also protecting our environment. And hopefully, given that I would be all powerful on this day, I would also magically have the answer to that problem. And everyone would listen to me and do what I said. So still slightly insane, but hopefully it would work.
The health of our freshwater ecosystem is, of course, something which has been in the news massively over the last couple of years with the pollution levels and everything else. So I think Greya's research comes at such a critical time to understand exactly how pollution, like pesticides that she mentioned, is impacting. Because the more we know about it, the more we can do to lobby to put regulations in to make those ecosystems a healthier place, not only for the wildlife, but for ourselves as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Greya's got a question for us.
What is the coolest bit of water that either of you have ever swum, scuba dived in? And what was it you saw that made it so cool?
That's a great question. We're both lucky that we've been diving before. I did my dive training in Tenerife, so there's loads of tropical fishes to see in beautiful warm waters as well. But to be honest, I think my favourite place is probably the west coast of Scotland, because there are... So many things to see. It's as diverse as our terrestrial habitats, if not more so. They're incredibly special places. And just snorkeling. And we went last year snorkeling. And the amount you see in sort of the kelp forests and the seagrass, there was loads. I think probably one of my favourites was seeing a pipefish, which kind of looks like, imagine a seahorse, and then get a rolling pin and sort of squish it and roll it out. Pipefish kind of
like
that.
Quite a good description.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're just really long, skinny, kind of seahorse-like things. But no, across the west coast of Scotland, there are so many things to see. So, yeah, if you haven't experienced it, go snorkeling. And obviously, you know, take it steady. You know, respect the habitat. Don't damage it. You know, like most kind of places you go, take only photographs, leave only footsteps, but only in... Maybe leave only bubbles? Is that what
ripples?
We should say?
Ripples?
Ripples? Leave only ripples.
Yeah, that's the marine equivalent.
Yeah.
I like that though, because a lot of the time when we think of UK environments, it's like dark, it's cold. Not many people like can go swimming or do go swimming. I mean, you've got to be careful with the pollution level in your local area. So do only enter the water if you know that it's safe to do so and hasn't been filled with sewage. But also, you know, when you do go out and you can go snorkeling and seeing what we've got, it is amazing. And I'm quite jealous of you doing your dive training in Tenerife, James, because I did it in a man-made lake in Southampton, which had only just been made. So it was still stilty and had no wildlife in it.
Yeah, I bet.
But it was a means to an end. You know, I got the qualification and that's what matters. But I'd say my favourite swimming diving experience was actually before I got my dive qualification. And I was quite lucky to go and volunteer when I was at university in the Bahamas. Now, it does sound very idyllic.
You've now trumped anything that I could ever say.
Do you know what? I'll hold my hands up. UK is equally as good as the Bahamas when it comes to marine life. It's just a little bit colder. When you've got your wetsuit, you're fine. But yeah, I went out to the Bahamas to volunteer. It does sound very idyllic, beach-like, you know, warm weather. It was hard work. It was really hard work. And I was volunteering with Bimini Shark Lab, which is over on the island of Bimini, surprisingly. And the whole premise was to understand sharks, tiger sharks, nurse sharks, lemon sharks. So I did a lot of research, actually, working on lots of various people's PhD projects about these amazing, misunderstood, misrepresented animals. That's where I got my slight obsession of sharks from, I think. But yeah, my best underwater encounter was going out to tag tiger sharks. And it was my first night there. I had no idea what I was doing at this point because I hadn't been trained yet, but I still got taken out by the team on a night excursion to go and find tiger sharks. And we were there. The stars were like no stars I've ever seen before, bioluminescence in the water. And then, you know, before we knew it, there was a tiger shark. And amazing. We were able to measure her and, you know, get DNA samples from her. And off she swam really strongly. And yeah, that moment has been a very important fuel, I think, for what I do now and my passion for the marine environment. But wherever you go, you can get moments like that. It doesn't have to be a shark. It can be, God, I get that looking at an anemone in a rock pool, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing about underwater habitats is it's still so alien to most of us. I think, you know, we grow up with parks and with kind of countryside, but to have encounters underwater, it is like going to a completely different planet. That kind of the feeling of submersion, the feeling of kind of weightlessness, and seeing all of this wildlife and abundance around us just shows how special these places are and how much harder we need to work to protect it.
So as we're coming to the end of this episode, we always like to leave you with something that you can do to keep up to date with the environment and to help it. And I thought we'd go for a freshwater theme, as we've just spoken to Greya. Now, something you can do to understand more about the pollution levels near where you live is go to surfaceagainstsewage.org.uk, where there is an in real time sewage discharge and pollution risk map, which tells you exactly the health of your rivers, your local sea, wherever you may be, and whether it is safe to go for a swim or not, or just to inform yourself on what's happening. So do track the changes in pollution close to where you are. You can also look at the River Action website, which has some really great ways and of which you can help kind of campaign for the health of our rivers. So highly recommend looking at those two websites, learn a little bit more about it. And like we said earlier, don't be afraid to use your voice. Maybe message your MP. Maybe that's your task for this week. Email your MP and ask for tighter restrictions about river quality for freshwater ecosystems.
There you go. You're getting the homework on this show now.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, write in and let us know that you've done it.
Yeah, let us know you've done it and I'll mark your email. And I'm But, you know, it's a great thing to do. And I've done it a few times about rivers and, you know, you'll always get a response, like I say. So do it. Keep up the pressure.
No, that's it. That's the end of episode 5, halfway through season 1. Thank you so much to everyone who's contributed to this episode. We'll be back again next Friday with some more weird and wonderful wildlife.
Yeah, I think the topic for next week is offspring. And I've got a great fact for that already. So
I've
you've got
a
bring
great
it.
Fact for that already.
All right. Oh, God. It's happening already.
Fight is on. But no, we'll see you the same time, same place.
Yeah, make sure to add your vote onto Twitter and let us know who won this week's What the Fact. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. You are the frogs follow.